Hi, everyone. I'm Ashley McManus, Director of Marketing at Affectiva. Welcome to Affectiva Asks, a human-centric AI podcast where each episode we will interview a thought leader doing cutting-edge work in the AI space. A little bit about us. Affectiva is the pioneer of emotion AI, software that can detect nuanced human emotions, complex cognitive states, behaviors, activities, and interactions. And Affectiva is applying this technology to optimize brand content and media spend by measuring consumer emotional responses to videos, ads, and TV shows unobtrusively and at scale. Today's episode features Dr. Rana Al-Kayubi and Graham Page from Affectiva talking with Cloud Army's President and CSO of Neuroscience, Tom Noble, about how emotion AI paired with neuroimplicit technologies can provide market researchers with richer and deeper insights. Affectiva is excited to partner with that Cloud Army, a cloud-based neuroscience research technology company. By integrating our technologies, we're able to deliver enhanced analytics that provide a full-brain picture of consumer response, design, and creativity. Let's listen in on the conversation to learn more.
Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. If you're joining us for the first time, I'm Rana Al-Kayubi, co-founder and CEO of Affectiva. We are an MIT spin-out on a mission to humanize technology by bringing emotional intelligence to our machines. I'm very excited for the conversation we're going to have today. So the conversation today is going to be focused on one of the applications of our technology, media analytics, where we are all about trying to understand the emotional engagement consumers and users have with content. And I'm excited to have Tom Noble, who is the President and Chief Strategy Officer of Cloud Army with us. Hi, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Pleased to be here.
And of course, Graham Page, who is the Global Managing Director of the Media Analytics Business at Affectiva. Hi, Graham.
Hi, Rana. Hi, everybody.
So I am in the company of two of the pioneers in the neuromarketing space. I know you both have known each other for a very long time. But Tom, you and I met in, 2011. You remember, you have a story to share about that. So why don't you do that?
Well, you mean that we had dinner, but you only had the appetizer with me and then went off somewhere else for the rest of the meal.
Right. It was a double date, but the date was with my mom. So, but yes, we met a while back, very early on in our journey at Affectiva. Why don't you share a little bit about your background?
Well, I'm a sort of brand marketer turned neuromarketer. And interesting. Graham and my paths crossed about 20 years ago, and we've been rivals, competitors most of that time, actually, haven't we, Graham? Uh-huh. Until now. A lot of mutual respect, hopefully, certainly from my side. But I've spent, I suppose, the last 20 years having been a kind of marketer with people like GSK and Disney and Diageo, getting very frustrated about creativity and wanting to find better ways to test the sort of more intuitive responses. And I spent the last sort of 20 years with neuroscientists and computer scientists around the world in exploring different methodologies and different ways to try and get better at finding richer, fresher insights from these new techs, science-based and behavioral techniques, and then adapting them for kind of commercial outputs. And today, the Cloud Army business, which, just talking about today, our kind of mission in a way is to try and make online neurotesting a kind of day-to-day reality. And we work, interestingly, not just with brand owners and other research partners, but we also work increasingly with creative agencies, design agencies, innovating companies to help their creative optimization all the way through the process. So we're very much in that kind of mold of test and learn, using these techniques to kind of refine ideas, concepts, and things right the way through the process, rather than just be testing at the pre-launch and then finding out, I wish we'd done this, months ago, and we've got something here that we can't now change. Oh my God. So that's us. That's what we do. We have a platform which is already loaded with a lot of tools, particularly things like eye tracking and a whole array of implicit response and association, rapid response type tools. And now facial expression, facial coding too, which adds an extra dimension for us in that kind of temporal moment by moment kind of way that it does. So we're very excited about this relationship. We're excited about sharing some interesting stuff with you today. Well, I hope you find it interesting as a kind of little taste of the kind of things we can do together.
That's awesome. Graham, why don't you share also your, like, I want to have a little bit of a discussion around how the neuromarketing landscape has changed over the last 10 years. Yep. So perhaps, Graham, why don't you share your background as well? I know I'm pretty sure some of our listeners have heard you here before, but for those who haven't, what was your kind of entry into the neuromarketing space?
Yep, no, happy to do that. And yeah, apologies for those who may have heard it before, but no, so as Tom was saying, you know, I go a long way back, kind of to the birth of the neuromarketing industry as it was. So, you know, I spent a lot of time at Millward Brown and Kantar, so working in the research industry around kind of brands and advertising, similar to Tom in many ways. But I did a lot of work looking at what the different methods from cognitive neuroscience brings to the research industry and the brand and ad research industry. So I did a lot of work just kind of, you know, looking at methodologies, and that's, I think, where we first crossed paths. And then I set up the neuroscience practice at Millward Brown. So bringing a lot of the methods from cognitive neuroscience to bear on brand and advertising research issues. So yes, that was, feels like a long time ago now, but that was back in 2010. And so I've, to varying degrees, I've kind of worked in this space, probably for 15 years. I think more than, I think I did my first EEG project in 2001, as I recall. So still have the picture of me wearing the headset, which I will burn at some point. So.
Has the data come out from it yet?
Just about, yeah. I think I got it. So yeah, so absolutely, yeah. So, you know, that was my background in neuromarketing, but obviously then I've worked with the Affectiva technology for 10 years as a client, and then also obviously moved over to the business 18 months ago now to run the media analytics division.
So Tom, what kind of evolution have you seen in both the adoption and acceptance of neuromarketing over the last, 10, 20 years?
Well, it's been refreshing. I say the last few years has been very, very refreshing. As those of us who've worked in labs will testify, you know, there's been a lot of sore heads or banging a head against a brick wall for the first 5 to 10 years. But I think certainly since the introduction of online tools, we've seen a very sort of healthy acceleration in adoption, which obviously comes with people, the risk, if you like, going out of it, the costs of being involved in it are not what they were. And the speed of turnaround is refreshingly faster, which, you know, talks to this whole idea of kind of rapid response and iterative responses. And so what we've seen, is, I would say, over the last few years is more and more adoption, more and more people ringing me up who said, "We thought you were mad, you know, when we first met you 10, 15 years ago, sticking electrodes on people's heads, saying, maybe the time is right to have another conversation with you." And so this has been, it's very nice in that sense. And, but I think we're also, what we're seeing is this sort of interest more and more in multimodal testing, I would say, is one of the key trends. So instead of just doing eye tracking or just doing implicit testing, starting to look at sort of the multimodal. We believe and see a great deal of interest in combining system one, system two methods rather than saying one is better than the other and just ditch the other one and go with this one. No, we think they've all got a role to play. But we're seeing, more and more adoption of this idea of, as I mentioned earlier in my little intro, of this sort of rapid test and learn iteration kind of way of working, which I think got a boost during the kind of credit squeeze where people just didn't have the money to invest in those big, heavy projects at the end. And they started to get into this notion of shorter, sharper kind of little and often. And that's really just kept going. And what we've now seen with the COVID kind of the forced closure or hampering of lab-based and central location-based work, the sort of acceleration of that kind of drift anyway into adding online tools. So I've absolutely no doubt that the lab-based businesses will come back, and they've got a very important role to play. They'll continue to grow once we're through this horrible mess, of COVID. But I think it's been seeing some of those kind of more versatile benefits that the sort of, in some cases, 24-hour turnaround of data, which allows us to do creative sprints, maybe, in a week, three different iterations of a creative optimization. And so that's sort of transforming the way people are even thinking about using these techniques. It's no longer slow, really, really expensive, and a little bit cumbersome. It's light and agile and highly scalable. Mm-hmm. So those are the main things, I'd say.
Yeah. And I think we'd echo that, I think, Tom. I think we've certainly seen, the adoption of kind of the more scalable technologies such as kind of emotion AI or facial expression analysis. Mm-hmm. That's been certainly accelerated by the COVID pandemic, as people who would perhaps normally have wanted to do something in a lab, in a lab-based setting with a physical sensor. They claim needed to find alternatives in a world where you just can't get people together in a single location. So, we were seeing, as you said, a kind of that trend anyway. And actually, I kind of look back to the early days of using the Effectiva technology myself. I think we were kind of slightly ahead of that curve initially. But it always had that prospect of being the scalable technology that would be able to be used, all over the world, without dragging people into venues. So we've certainly seen that accelerate in the last 18 months since the pandemic. But it's been happening anyway. The only other build, by the way, I think I'd say in terms of trends in neuromarketing, can be on what you said, is I think it's really interesting to me now that the nomenclature of System 1 and System 2, Type 1 and Type 2 processing, the need to understand.
We actually defined that, Graham, for any folks who are tuned in but don't know what those are.
Sure, can absolutely. So there's the idea that probably has been most popularized by Daniel Kahneman and in books like Thinking Fast and Slow. There's this idea that the brain essentially has, if you like, kind of two types of processing: the kind of fast, intuitive, automatic processing that happens very quickly and very effortlessly, and a lot of our kind of instinctive emotional responses fit into that category. And then there's a kind of type two or system two processing, which is more considered and abstracted and effortful. And that's often what we think of as thinking in kind of layperson's language, but that's actually only part of the picture. So there's this idea that both these systems are actually working together. You always have a system one, type one reaction that then you kind of think about a little bit harder with type two processing. And there's this acknowledgement, I think, that's happened over the last certainly 10 years that, both those systems are really relevant for decision making. And it's interesting to me that when research briefs are written now, one of the first questions that they'll often ask is, okay, how are you going to measure type one or system one processes? How are you going to measure unconscious reactions? Mm-hmm. Whereas 10 years ago, when we started, we were often the ones taking that thinking to clients and saying, okay, look, this is why we need to do this, because there is this whole system decision-making that you're probably not tapping into with the current work. So that's been, I think, a real change over the last 10 years, is that's become a mainstream concept. And as a consequence, there's greater interest in the kind of technologies that Cloud Army and Affectiva bring to bear.
I was going to say there's one other thing as well, I think, that I kind of alluded to, which is, what we're seeing is the creative industries themselves interested in, if you like, taking back control to some degree of the creative process. Mm-hmm. And so we work, as I say, increasingly with creative teams who are looking to evolve that creative through the process, and will present back to their brand owners, if you like, at key stages using their methodology and sharing that methodology with the brand owners. And more often than not, we're seeing traction where that methodology then becomes used by the end brand owner as well. Because it's a kind of more in tune with the creative process, if you like, is measuring things at a kind of non-conscious intuitive level, which is the level at which the creatives are actually trying to design and create. So once you get over the hurdle with creatives whose initial reaction is, what, you're a neuroscientist and you're trying to get us to do things by numbers, are you? You say, no. Let's have a conversation about intuition and where that comes from. And once you've opened that conversation up and they realize we're measuring the very thing that they're trying to induce and trigger, it's a very different conversation. Not always, but increasingly we're having some joy there. And it's, I think it's a very refreshing and a different kind of approach.
Yeah, I love this. We have had many, many conversations over the years on how to break into the creative process and work with the creators of content, as opposed to kind of the brand owners or the marketers, which is where a lot of our work ends up being. So I like this concept of a creative sprint. And how do you kind of use this technology to inform, decision making and iterations of the creative process? Mm. Very cool.
And I think there's one other area of kind of creativity that is also starting to sort of impinge and getting traction with, which is the whole behavioral science kind of area, which has had an interesting relationship with neuro. And a lot of people, myself included, thinking, well, how do these two things fit together? And, you know, the way that we kind of talk about neuro with our clients, and we work a lot with behavioral science agencies who come up with creative nudges, et cetera, is that, you know, the creativity that goes into coming up with ideas that are kind of embedded in heuristics and so on. So they're smart strategies that they know are more likely to trigger the desired action or behavioral effect. The role of neuro in that context is to help assess which of those is the most compelling, which of those is most likely to actually deliver in the marketplace and trigger the kind of feelings and attitudes and induce the behaviors that are part of the brief. So those two things coming together is again something that we see. And I think that is also very exciting.
Absolutely. Mm. So let's talk about our partnership a little bit. Graham, do you want to share a little bit of background on how this connection came about and where are we with the partnership?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, you know, Tom mentioned earlier that you know, he and I have been competitors over the years, but it has definitely come from a position of mutual respect. And so when the opportunity came to, I guess, bring our technologies and the Cloud Army technologies together, that felt like too good an opportunity to miss. So the partnership involves, you know, as working together with the Cloud Army platform to, you know, add, you know, our emotion AI technology. So our ability to use algorithms and AI to understand people's facial expressions and from that infer their emotional and cognitive states. You know, we're bringing that technology together with Cloud Army's platform to, you know, enable a much wider view, I think, of people's system one, type one intuitive reactions to all sorts of things. You know, obviously we very much specialize or have tended to be used historically to measure reactions to dynamic content, be that, you know, an experience, be that an ad, be that a piece of entertainment content. But clearly, you know, that can be really closely allied, I think, with then the kind of technologies that Tom's business produces. So the measurement of reactions and ideas evoked by concepts and ideas, you know, those two things coming together, I think, is a really powerful thing and provides a very rounded view of people's reactions. So that's the idea. Tom, why don't you talk a little bit more about kind of, you know, your thoughts on this and
yeah, good idea. Thanks, Graham. Yeah, I mean, from our perspective, essentially what we have on the Reactor platform, the Cloud Army Reactor platform, is an array of different tools that are designed to answer different kinds of questions, attentional questions, perceptual type questions and behavioral type questions. But a lot of them are sort of grounded in our kind of deep commitment, if you like, and investment in implicit association type testing, of which there are many types and forms. And we have many, many different types of paradigms rather than, say, one specific way of doing it. The benefit of the implicit type of reaction time testing is it's incredibly adaptable to answer all kinds of different questions that researchers have, and not just researchers, politicians and educationists and now lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's probably the most widely, most of our solutions have somewhere in their combination of tools together some form of implicit response, often two or three different types of implicit type responses. But what's missing from that is a kind of moment by moment kind of metric. And, you know, having been born with a sort of EEG, a lot of EEG sort of work in my earlier days, you know, that the ability to have temporal data is really, really valuable and invaluable in certain types of work. And so it's for us, it's a natural thing to be looking at and to come to people who've got, you know, a great capability on it, benchmarks, you know, which is there for everybody. And it fits very nicely on the platform and integrates very nicely on the platform. So we're right at the beginning of this kind of partnership, but we've got some plans for not just testing the kind of things that we're going to talk about a bit today, you know, advertising testing and so on. But, you know, we want to explore. We're a company that loves, very curious about exploring different ways of doing things and trying to get better at the implicit stuff and everything else for that matter. And try and work, you know, with academics as well to invite them to use the system to find better ways, this sort of journey of discovery. And I think that things about which appeal about facial expressions, you know, when we're doing work, for example, on sensory work for people's reactions to new scents or aromas or mm-hmm. to different textures or to flavors, yep. ghastly flavors or right. delightful flavors, right. you know, those kind of instant reactions seem to be something we could add to the mix mm-hmm. and concepts, so innovations of all sorts. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in my earlier life testing still concepts, but to animate those concepts and make them into this dynamic kind of, I don't know, 5 or 10 second thing, you get more of an unfolding. You can actually pick up perhaps some of the reactions. Those are some of the ideas. They may be, you know, unworkable, they may prove valuable, but those are the sort of things we'd like to be exploring with you guys going forward.
Yeah, that's very exciting. So we are going to talk about one of the ads we tested. So why this particular ad, and perhaps we can dive into some of our findings.
You know, in testing something, just to kind of illustrate and give a flavor of, you know, what the combination of these tools can do together. We were looking, weren't we, Graham, for something that sort of told a story that was a classic use of facial expression work and also, you know, the kind of stuff that we do a great deal of too, and put the two things together. A lot of people often ask, you know, where's the greatest value come from using, you know, system one type tools? And, you know, I mean, there are different answers to that question, but I would say that one of the areas is in creative testing, mm-hmm. and particularly in ad testing, and particularly in ad testing where there's an emotional kind of component. There's a very important element to the ad, and so it just so happened that this ad popped up, the Cadbury's cream egg ad, and it popped up because there'd already been a bit of controversy about it. Uh-huh. And so we thought, well, you know, why not take that ad and put it through our test and share some of those kind of learnings with you guys. And this is an illustration of you know, the combination of facial expression and implicit testing together with some system one, system two stuff as well. So we it's actually a four-part test. But Graham, did you want to add anything to?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's an interesting example because, again, often, you know, these kind of technologies that tap into system one, type one processing are often very powerful when there might be something that people don't want to say, or there might be a difference between what people want to say and how they actually reacted. So this is an interesting spot in that it's a continuation of, and we should probably explain this product for those who don't know it as well. It's a continuation of the Cadbury's cream egg campaign that has been used for a long time. A Cadbury's cream egg is I don't know how widely they're sold around the world, but in the UK,
in the UK, I ate far more of these than I'm supposed to.
Quite. They are a bit of a guilty pleasure for many, but they're an egg-shaped confectionery chocolate, quite thick chocolate shell with a kind of thick fondant kind of center that is kind of made to look somewhat like an egg. It's got like a little yellow yolk and a white, they're quite indulgent things, and obviously the big time for that. These are sold all year round, but the big time for them is obviously around Easter. So there's always an advertising campaign around Easter. A lot of it has historically centered on kind of the way that the product can be eaten, because it can be a bit of a mess and so on. So this year's campaign was particularly interesting. It kind of continued that idea of, you know, there being different ways to eat the brand, but also was somewhat controversial because so within it there was a gay couple featured, and there was a kiss is perhaps too strong a word, but you know, there's a moment of potential intimacy, which again was somewhat controversial. So the ad did attract, you know, a petition of 26,000 people saying they wanted it banned and so on. So it was somewhat controversial and felt therefore like an interesting example where we could perhaps, you know, take a look at it and see if people really were actually, if the general population were offended, or was it just a tiny minority of people? And also, even, you know, in that wider population, were there moments within it that people struggled with or didn't? So it felt like a good opportunity to contrast what people said with how they reacted on a system one. So that's the rush.
Where did we test? And can you talk a little bit about the sample? And also, where did it air? So where did these petitions come from?
Yeah, so it was a UK test. You know, it's a very, I don't know entirely, but it's absolutely, you know, in the UK, it has got a sort of iconic status as a brand. So we tested it in the UK, and we were testing it amongst chocolate eaters, 200 of those, you know, just to give a kind of taster, as it was, as a sample. And in terms of, you know, how we tested it, we had 200 people going through the affectiva test. And then we had three layers of our testing in terms of true implicit testing, you know, whereas it's disguised test, which is really get the kind of the system one kind of read, against which we were testing. We pulled four scenes from that, which we'll have a look at in a second. There's six vignettes in the ad. We tested four of those vignettes against a couple of different attributes for me and yummy and yuck, which is well understood in the UK. Uh-huh. And then we had a next layer of testing, which is what we call fast choice, which is a kind of rapid response where you're in very limited time to answer the question. And the direction of the answer you give is important, but also the time with which you give it is an indication of how committed you are to that particular choice. So that's fast choice testing. And that allowed us to test six attributes in relating to tastiness and for me, and for whether the ad was felt to be cause offence either to yourself or to other people, those kind of metrics. And then we had some self-report questions. So what did people actually think of the ad? Do they like it? Would they buy and try the product? Those kind of things that you would typically always ask in order to provide a counterpoint, if you like, to some of the implicit and the behavioural data that we were collecting as well. So that was essentially the test.
Yeah. And obviously, as you know, just for clarity, so when people were recruited for this and they watched the ad, that was the point where, with their consent, they agreed to be filmed. Those recordings of people watching the ad were then processed by our emotion AI system, and we were able to understand the different expressions they showed, and from that understand their emotional reactions in the moment, in the kind of context of the narrative. So that this, I think, is one of the interesting kind of juxtapositions of these two technologies, is that the facial data really responds to people's in the moment kind of processing as they're watching, where they have the full context and narrative, you know, very salient in the mind as they watch. And then the Cloud Army techniques allow us to go a bit deeper into specific moments and then say, okay, let's look at that again and understand the emotions that specific moment triggers and the depth of association. So we'll share a bit on that in a second.
Yes. So you know, we tested it here. We took four of those. There's six vignettes, I believe, altogether. We chose four of them to test. It's a manageable amount. We're testing those both with the implicit test and with the fast choice, you know, that rapid response testing as well. And we're going to share the results of that later.
But yeah, I think, you know, we should dive in a little bit about what was said. I mean, what was interesting here was, obviously, you know, there were, as we said earlier, some complaints about that ad, and you can see the scene that a lot of that was focused on. I think what was interesting was certainly when you took those explicit results from the survey, Tom, you know, it was clear, wasn't it, that actually the majority of people did not say that was an offensive ad, certainly in the UK population.
Correct. Yeah.
We saw most people saying, yeah, actually disagreeing quite strongly that it was offensive. A few more people actually said, yeah, other people might find it offensive, not me. But still, majority of people didn't think it would be offensive. And actually, many said it was quite progressive. So I thought that was kind of, it was interesting, just based on the explicit questions, you know, there didn't appear to be an overall problem with that.
It was, as you say, progressive was something that, that came out. They liked it and they would, you know, they would purchase the product and everything. So nothing to give you sort of, not to ring alarm bells, put it that way, to the extent that, that the complaints actually suggested otherwise.
Yeah. But I guess, as you were saying earlier, Tom, you know, what people say explicitly isn't always the whole picture, right? So I think it was then interesting to kind of get into what some of the more implicit measures said. And I thought it was quite interesting that actually the implicit measures did highlight some negative responses to certain scenes, but overall it kind of suggested that if people have a problem with the ad, it's not necessarily because they have a problem with that scene of the gay couple sharing the product. It might actually be more to do with the fact that people are a bit grossed out by some of the some of the eating behaviors that were being shown. So, you know, if there was a negative reaction, it wasn't perhaps for the reasons that you might think, given the controversy. So, yeah, Tom, why don't you say a little bit more about?
I think the clue there is it's more complex than sort of meets the eye. And when you asked people what they felt about different eating habits, they were very happy to rank order how disgusting various things were. And at the top of the list was eating with your mouth open, something else I'm sure nobody ever does.
Of course.
Sharing with pets, which is one of my pet hates, I have to say. Finger licking is not something that people like to see. And sharing directly with others, those were the sort of the top four, which you keep in mind. Sharing with others is there. And when you look at the implicit, there's sort of this deeper level implicit result about how people reacted to the attributes for me and for sort of yumminess versus yuckiness. In actual fact, you know, what would be slightly concerning is that all of the scenes were seen as being sort of a little bit negative, at least a little bit negative, sometimes more than that. And the only scene that was really positive was the end frame with the product shot, which is good. But there is something that's kind of inherently, so you use the word gross, there's something uncomfortable and something that I think viscerally we kind of react against. And this squares with other work that we've done historically, looking at rituals and experiences of people eating stuff in a fair amount of forensic detail. And it is something that is not new. It is something you have to be a bit watchful of. The two scenes which probably scored the least well in terms of that implicit thing was the sharing scene, the kiss scene, but also the dipping scene with the fingers going into the product. Those two were not responded to very well in terms of our data.
That is fascinating. So a few thoughts, right? First of all, it sounds like these two behaviors, the dipping and the sharing, are kind of controversial regardless of the fact that this was a, you know, a couple, for example, right?
Yeah.
Is this aired like a few weeks ago, right? Like we're still in a pandemic. You're not really supposed to be licking your fingers and you're not really supposed to be sharing food. Yeah. So I wonder if that's a factor or it sounds like you've tested a lot of food stuff in the past. Do you think the pandemic is a factor in the response or not really?
It's interesting you should say the pandemic thing. I think people are maybe heightened by hygiene in a way that they haven't been before. And I mean, this is just as an aside, we didn't test this specifically, but you'll notice, for those of you who were really sharp-eyed, you'll notice in the dipping sequence, in she has a surgical glove on.
Right.
Which I'd imagine, you know, so certainly from the strange way the mind works, you know, that one would not be surprised if that conjured up at a non-conscious level all sorts of connotations about, you know, which are unhelpful, one could say, to the pleasure of eating and consuming you know, a wonderful product. So, yeah, I think those sort of things, one has to be, you know, the context of COVID is probably an interest, you know, it's probably caused some complications, if you like. For sure.
Certainly when you looked at people's facial responses as they watched,
right,
and you can actually see the way these things change is kind of interesting. So that moment of kind of the dipping moment of the character kind of dipping her fingers in the eggs and then holding them up so she can lick them off. Clearly you see a quite a strong downward movement in the smiles and an upward movement in the frowns. And that's by far the clearest, I think, transition moment in the ad. The moment that was kind of complained about by some, you know, the gay couple and them sharing the product, you know, yes, there was a bit of an uptick in some of the frowns, but actually you didn't really see the smile trace decline. And certainly it's a less, there may be a bit of a negative reaction there, but it's certainly a less clear signal than the signal that we're seeing for the, you know, the dipping moment. And in contrast, actually, there are a couple of other moments that are actually a little bit more positive. So there is a kind of an uptick in smiles when people are kind of showing the kind of licking moment. And actually, that's probably, I think, the most common way of eating things. So there might be some empathy there. And then, as Tom was saying, you know, actually the product scenes towards the end, the product being shown. And so actually, again, we're seeing upticks in positivity, at least on people's faces as they watch. So it kind of in the moment, it certainly seems to suggest that the strongest negative response is actually to that kind of finger dipping moment. And actually there's, you know, that seems to be a bit, you know, a bit more muted when it comes to, you know, the more potentially controversial moment. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Tom, do you want to just say a little more about the implicit results?
Yeah, so I mean, maybe should we flip to the fast choice results? Remember, this is there's a rapid response test. You can see there this is based on average this performance against average, but the sharing and the finger dipping are the ones that, you know, kind of not performing as well as the other two. It's interesting that I think that just picking up what you were saying then from the facial expression work, the licking is the one that, you know, a lot of people identify themselves as Cadbury cream egg lickers. It's not just you, Rana. So it is a very common way to, and I think it's probably the simplest and the least messy way to consume these things. Maybe that has an inherent advantage, if you like, in terms of their overall kind of halo effect of the responses we're picking up. But you can see some challenges there with the sharing. But, you know, at the degree to which that is to do with the depiction of a gay couple versus that idea that there's a product there that they're both sharing directly in a fairly sort of uncomfortable kind of way, you know, it could be just as likely that that's the root of the challenge, you know, which you get with the finger dipping thing as well. You get a negativity there. So it's, I think the short answer is, you know, it is more complicated than just, you know, a reaction to a gay couple.
Yeah.
There's other things going on there that one might need to be watchful of, you know, in the context of whatever the intent was in the ad, because we don't actually know, unfortunately, know what the marketing team and the ad team were actually trying to achieve in terms of, you know, how provocative they were hoping to be, mm-hmm. and whether they were hoping to stir things up a little bit to get social media, whatever. We don't know that. But certainly the results suggest that there's a potential challenge there to depict rituals in a way that may not be the most kind of motivating. There may be other ways to have the same impact, if you like, but you know, create the ritual but do it in a slightly more positive way.
Yeah, yeah, that's very interesting. Did we actually share these results with the brand?
Not as yet.
Yeah, not as yet. I say this was an ad that we chose for illustrative purposes. Now that said, I think there are some interesting kind of implications, and you know, Tom said it, it's a little tricky to you know, to infer exactly what the goals were without talking directly to the team. So, you know, we wouldn't want to go too far down the kind of, oh, here's our advice. But I think it is interesting that it struck me that it seems to be tapping into the rituals of the user. So as a means of making the brand more salient to its core audience, it's probably working quite effectively. But then that wider risk, perhaps more negative response to some of the eating processes in among the wider population, again, perhaps suggests it's not going to bring new people into the franchise, right? Or new people into, you know, into the product. But Tom, were there any things you'd add to that in terms of what we might have said to the team?
No, I mean, I think that one of the things we did do, which I didn't mention up front, was we chose to test the ad silent, mm-hmm. and with the voiceover. You know, we had a suspicion that maybe the voiceover was potentially polarizing or you know, just interesting in a sense. And we actually do more and more work in audio and music and stuff like that, because it's like one of those things that's always seems to be last considered, mm-hmm. you know, by the agency. Has been difficult to test using traditional methods. So implicit testing and potentially now facial expression testing of music and voiceover, I think it's a very rich and fertile area that we, you know, we're very keen and very enjoy doing. It was very interesting, the results on this, because we got virtually no difference between the with and without audio, which itself is I've not really seen that quite like that before. You normally have a profound difference, or certainly a significant difference at certain stages. And if there was a scintilla of evidence that perhaps the silent one had a couple of strengths as well over the voiceover. So I think that's something that's certainly worth looking at. It depends, again, what the intent was with the mm-hmm. voiceover. It's a particular kind of parody or particular style of voiceover, which obviously chosen, I would have thought, quite deliberately. So, but again, not knowing what the intention was, it's hard for us to comment. But I thought that was a very interesting finding. Didn't you, Graham?
You would typically expect that an ad without voiceover, you know, without that added explanatory element would struggle more. So again, it just makes you wonder to what extent that was adding, you know, huge value to the final version. But again, that would be something we talk to the team about. But it's certainly true that, you know, we've seen in lots of the, you know, the work that we do, particularly in advertising, that the soundtrack and the voiceover can make a huge difference. So, you know, even, you know, the, you know, music in particular also makes a massive difference to the emotional response. Different soundtracks can, to the same visuals, can absolutely produce a different emotional response with different music. But even things like the balance of music versus dialogue can make a difference. Mm-hmm. There's a case I can think of recently where there was an ad that was specifically actually, it was deliberately in a foreign language. For the market it was playing in, and it was because it was trying to kind of evoke the spirit of the country of origin of the brand, and so there was one version of the ad that had quite a high foreign language soundtrack and low music, and then there's another version which actually had quite a louder kind of soundtrack that really kind of suppressed the audio a little bit. And actually people found that latter one, I think, easier to deal with, because they stopped trying to work out what the voice was actually saying, and actually just kind of went with the spirit and flow of the narrative and the music and the feel that the music gave them. So, you know, it can make quite a big difference, even quite subtle.
I think what this kind of pilot test is demonstrating is that it's a partnership with the creative team, right? Like if the creators of this, you know, of this particular ad had access to these results early on in the iterative design process, perhaps, you know, and again, we don't know the intent, so it's hard to say, but this interplay of this like really visceral responses to these eating rituals with like this other dimension of the gay couple, like it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of interesting to be able to decouple these early on in the design process and then make decisions accordingly.
One last comment on the voiceover is that just to be clear, we noticed no difference in the attributes that we were testing and the reaction we were testing. That doesn't mean to say that they may have at the agency and the client a very different array of attributes and associations, which all came through very, very strongly. We just don't know that. It's just like, you know, the things we felt were important for this little pilot, there was no resonation there between the difference between the two.
That's a really good point. So fascinating. So back to this idea of testing audio, have we collectively as a team thought about testing podcast responses? I feel like that's an area, I mean, it's an area that just seems untapped.
Yeah, we've certainly done one or two historically in that space. So and in fact, you know, it is an area of increased interest, right? You know, we do quite a bit of long form entertainment content and podcasts absolutely fit into that bucket. So that's quite possible to do. Tom, you may have also done the same, right?
Yes, I think there's an interest in podcasts and advertising, you know, the voice overs from the protagonist from the broadcast or the podcasters versus professional athletes. Yes. Right. Clearly, there's a difference there. And clearly, there are things that could probably work in that regard in some respects, but there's also some concerns that maybe they wouldn't. You know, how believable is it that to the audience that the message which is being given across, the advertising message is, you know, is believed in. I mean, that's right. There's those sort of things you can imagine. There's an interest already in that space.
Very cool. So thoughts on where we're taking this next? I know we talked obviously about content testing, maybe podcast testing, product testing, but yeah, where are we going next with this?
I'm sort of really excited, you know, with the team back at the ranch to explore all sorts of areas. I mean, you guys have a lot of experience in doing lots of different things. We obviously tend to think about advertising and trailers and high emotional stuff that this is obviously tailor-made for the expression work. But I do think that those ideas on sensory, interesting, experiential work, of which there's more and more ideas and stuff coming out all the time, and measuring that has not been that easy, I think, using traditional methods. That's another very interesting area, I think. So, yeah, sensory, experiential, innovation work, and any sort of, you know, digital AV content. Yeah. But yeah, I think there's some good exploration to be done there.
Yeah, and again, I'd go along with that. I think, you know, we've often been asked to, and on occasion, projects in things like fragrance testing and so on. And so again, being able to, you know, work with Cloud Army on that, I think is a really great opportunity to do more of that kind of work. And likewise, you know, getting a little bit earlier in both the kind of creative development process, but also in the innovation process around kind of concepts, particularly if people are being presented with a dynamic concept in some way, I think that could be a really interesting way of adding a lot more richness to that phase of testing and beginning to understand what the winning ideas are earlier on. I mean, a lot of our work is currently kind of the animatic stage as well as the finished films that we're kind of testing here. But yeah, going even further into the product process and creative process is something we're really interested in.
Very cool. Thank you, Tom, for joining us again. This was awesome.
A pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, our cementing our partnership together.
Great stuff. Thank you.
As we saw in the recent Cadbury chocolate ad case study, Cloud Army and Affectiva used a combination of facial coding and implicit methodologies to uncover and contrast the self-reported versus science-led data to take a deeper look at the ad that had sparked some public controversy. I hope you enjoy today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to Affectiva's Human-Centric AI podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts for new episodes. We're also on social media, so please reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram at Affectiva to share any feedback you have on the show and weigh in on a discussion using hashtag AffectivaAsks. Don't forget to rate us and comment with your feedback to help make the podcast more discoverable for others. Until next time, thanks for listening.